This is Polling Matters in association with politicalbetting.com. My name is Kieran Pedley. This week's podcast asks the question, why is polling so difficult? Later on, I will be discussing this issue with fellow podcaster Rob Vance and Suzanne Terminassian of ICM, an expert in French opinion polling, to get her perspective on what happens there and where regulation of polling is much tighter. The question may sound unkind, but there is a serious point to be made here. Political opinion polls are very different to traditional market research, where you might ask someone what type of toothpaste they use or how satisfied they are with their energy provider. There are similarities, of course, both involve surveys usually, but polling does blur the line between a respondent's current opinion and figuring out how they might actually behave in the future, in a way that most forms of market research do not, although some do. Put another way, in public opinion polls, you rarely take the respondent's word for it. All pollsters take data and extrapolate from that data what they think the true state of public opinion is. Voting intention polls are snapshots, of course, not predictions, as Lord Ashcroft once said, but when you can't take the public's word at face value, a certain degree of judgment is needed. Pollsters do this whilst all the while dealing with something of a moving target. Party systems change, and accurately balancing the samples surveyed to ensure you have an accurate reflection of people actually vote is very difficult too. All of this makes polling very challenging, especially in unique situations such as referendums or party leadership contests. When things go wrong, as they did this year, then calls for closer regulation get louder. This all matters, of course I would say that because of the title of this podcast, but polling can influence our political discourse. We saw it during the campaign and will no doubt see it in the future. Policies and leaders can live and die in the court of public opinion. So this week, the podcast looks at why polling is so difficult and what can be done about it. We'll be discussing the Greek referendum, Labour's leadership contest, and Lord Foulkes' plans to regulate the industry, which is a discussion that's ongoing. We'll also be talking about the British Polling Council inquiry and some of the issues that are starting to arise there. I started the discussion this week with Rob and Suzanne by outlining Lord Foulkes' plans and asking what they thought of them and what happens elsewhere. So let's crack on with the British Polling Council inquiry. I mean, just to sort of recap on where we are. Last month, we had Lord Foulkes submit his bill to the House of Lords, and it's now cleared that formality of getting a second reading. He summarised in that debate quite a lot of the issues we know that he's concerned with. He's been on this podcast before, as regular listeners will know. He's obviously very concerned about the academic rigour that goes into polling. He's concerned with how polling shapes the political discourse in this country around general elections, referendums, and so forth. And he thinks that the best way to solve some of these problems is to have a statutory body that makes recommendations on how opinion polls should be conducted. Before we look at his plans and what maybe happens elsewhere, do we think he has his criticisms have any merit? I mean, Rob, what do you think?
So I think Lord Foulkes' bill, we talked about this a lot before. Lord Foulkes has, I think, a bigger problem with the media than he does with the polling industry. And I think in some ways it's easier to pick on the polling industry than it is to pick on the journalists and the way that they write up polls. As Suzanne has written previously, there are all sorts of challenges to deal with the actual like hardcore regulatory kind of approach that he wants to take. And I feel like, especially with the ongoing inquiry that's going on, I think that Lord Foulkes' bill is a bit of a distraction. I think what's important at this moment in time is for the industry itself to work out where it went wrong or where it didn't do as well as it might have done. And in a sense, to then have a different kind of discussion to do with, you know, Lord Foulkes' issues. Because, frankly, lots of the ways in which Lord Foulkes might ideally want to see these things resolved wouldn't have done anything about the result of the recent election. And I think, in a sense, his bill is jumping on a bit of a bandwagon in terms of pollsters as the bogeymen, which I think is pretty unhelpful.
Suzanne, what's your impressions of Lord Foulkes in terms of his criticisms of the polling industry? Because, to be fair, you know, there are issues about how the polling industry can shape the political debate, aren't there?
Yeah, if the problem is whether the polling industry is accurate, then obviously, yes, there is a problem. We collectively had a problem in May. Then I'm not sure what he's proposing is going to make any difference. If they can give us tomorrow the solution to all our methodology issues, then yes, that would be great. but I'm not sure there's anything that this proposed commission can do that the British Polling Council is not already doing. And it's just adding some suspicion around polling, which is not always healthy in a political debate.
Because, Rob, I mean, ultimately, I suppose one of the criticisms the polling industry has of what Lord Falk's plans to do is that it stifles innovation. So, you know, I guess it's logical that as we move forward in the polling industry after what happened in 2015, that different pollsters are going to have different solutions to what went wrong, maybe different ways of, I don't know, asking the questions or priming respondents for that sort of ballot box experience or waiting by differential turnout, these sorts of things. And, you know, if it feels like if you have a sort of hard and fast set of rules in terms of how things should and shouldn't be done, then that innovation is lost. And if anything, if there's one thing we probably do want to avoid as an industry in the future, it's just all conforming to the same approach.
I couldn't agree more. And I think what we... It's one of these things where the polling inquiry is quite explicit about this, that in a sense, the idea that all the pollsters got it similarly wrong for the same reason is, I think, a really, really big issue, and I think is quite erroneous. It could well be that, you know, the particular kinds of issues with online sampling, which were having some effects, which might well be correlated with some issues that people using phone or other kind of contact methods were having, but are actually different issues at root. And already in terms of the aftermath, we're seeing Servation, I think, sticking quite strongly to a kind of it was late swing line. We've got evidence that suggests it's late swing, which I know has been debated, but in a sense, the merits of whether that's true or not is irrelevant. I mean, the fact is that, you know, some people are saying it's mainly lazy Labour. Some people are saying it's actually the Shy Tories. There is something in that. Some people are saying that it's late swing. And each of them could be right for their own methodology, in a sense. But, you know, the idea is that they're each of them trying to work out what went wrong and sharing that information. And then, you know, I think over the course of the next series of elections, whether it's, Scottish elections, local elections, EU referendum, any of these things, you know, lots of these things are going to get tried out and tested. And that's kind of the way to do it. I think if we'd said before the election... First of all, it was far from clear before the election of which methodologies were most right or most wrong. And we talked at the time about, you know, different pickups of UKIP support and all sorts of other things. It would be pretty problematic to be in a situation where the only form of, acceptable methodology was one which, you know, could then have turned out to have been wrong. And then we wouldn't have had any other kind of methodologies in order to, you know, cross-reference where it could be improved.
One of the things I'm interested in talking about, and Suzanne's going to help us out with this, is what happens in other countries, specifically around regulation. Suzanne, you're very experienced, obviously, in polling in France. Maybe explain to the listeners a bit about what happens there in terms of how things are done, but also regulation too.
Yeah, so essentially in France, there's a regulatory body, which is called the Commission des Sondages, which is exactly what Falk is trying to implement, and it's quite clear from the debates that is referenced quite often. So it has exactly the same powers, so the power to ban the publication of polling for a certain time before an election, and the power to decide which methodology is accepted and which ones are not. So what happens if you do not comply with those methodology is that they publish an adjudication telling everyone your polling is rubbish. So it's not exactly nice.
And who's on that commission or body? Is that
it's quite interesting. It's actually senior civil servants, with two people out of 12 having, well, knowledge in statistics, but there's no industry representation at all. So it's not exactly the best people to talk to when you're talking about polling. And it's all the more so interesting that there's no equivalent to the British Polling Council. There's no French Polling Council, which would represent the industry. So it's really pure regulation with no sort of...
So are these statisticians, though? Or
there are, well, one secretary of the commission, which, well, has been working there for quite a while, so he knows about polling, and a statistician that, well, when I was sitting in that commission, in front of that commission, was from the ONS. So it's not necessarily polling per se, but there is someone representing the statistical side of things.
So you've sat in front of that commission. So maybe give the listeners a bit about your background and kind of how you've maybe interacted with this commission in the past.
Oh dear. So it's not the best moment in my life, not the proudest moment in my career. But I published a survey that was called in question by, apparently, what the rumours say, another polling company. But the commission can be called upon by a political party or...
Because you used to run political polling in France, just to...
Used to run political polling for the French office of YouGov. So I published this poll and was called by this commission. So you then have 48 hours to prepare your defence. And then you sit in front
Sounds
of...
Sounds ominous.
That was a bit stressful. Yeah. I've had nicer times. But then again, it's not as bad as sitting on live TV on an election night and having to explain why your results are wrong. So that's not as bad as the sort of pressure of public opinion. Mm. And that's something that's quite important to bear in mind, I think, when we're talking about regulation. It's better when it's public. It hurts even more.
So you go and give your evidence, so to speak, and then they adjudicate on what exactly, on whether you're right or wrong, or
so they can they can judge on your sampling, weighting, and wording of your questions. So that's the things they can look at. But they also have a set of methodologies that they agree with or don't agree with. When they do their adjudication, they do not justify why what you've done is not good or not. They just explain, given what we've heard, we consider this polling to be not representative and we would advise everyone to just discard it. So the reputational impact is quite strong.
So, I mean, listening to all of this, I guess that if I'm Lord Foulkes and I'm hearing about this commission in France, then, you know, if it turns out that the French opinion polls are more accurate than the British ones, then I'm all in favour of this. It sounds like it works. So have the French polls been wrong in the past as well?
Yeah, they have. So 1995 was actually a really bad election for pollsters, and they did not predict who was going to win in the first round. So that was one bad election, and there was another one in 2002, where this time it's actually they did not call Le Pen the late rise in Le Pen voting intentions, and he actually, that failure to predict Le Pen's result actually ended up deciding for the result of the second round, and Chirac was elected for a second 5 years.
Hmm. Okay, it doesn't actually sound like then the presence of this commission makes French polls any less likely to be inaccurate than British polls either.
But it also flags the danger in inaccurate polling, which is why, you know, getting the right result is so important. You know, in 2002... You know, the fact was, you know, because you have a runoff system for the election, the French people kind of got a second bite at the cherry in terms of you had all these patriotic socialists saying, I would never vote for Chirac ever, but, you know, obviously we need to go and do my patriotic duty and vote for Chirac instead of Le Pen, because we can't have Le Pen as president. But, you know, in this time round, you know, the polls continually predicting a hung parliament was very much a reason, I believe, for a number of people, you know, holding their noses maybe in some cases and voting Tory because they were concerned about the SNP's role in a hung parliament. And, you know, that again, you know, reflects the importance of the polling being accurate. But, you know, if in a sense you can have that outcome, whether it's regulated or not.
But the SNP rise was there, wasn't it? But I suppose, are you saying that if the Conservatives had been 5 points ahead in the polls, then the political narrative would have been different?
It would have been completely different.
The thing is, it's always impossible to predict.
Of course.
So wrong polls can sort of help a party or just...
Of course. I'm not suggesting for a second that the polling industry is responsible for the outcome of the election. I just think the entire narrative of the election would have been very, very different. I think even like things like the Conservative Manifesto would probably have been quite different if there had been a 5-point lead that was being consistently reflected in the polls, and the conversation in the the conversation about the election would have been, will the Conservatives have a majority, or will it be, you know, will there be the biggest party with needing support and so on, which is ultimately, I suppose, if we think about it, where the kind of plus or minus however many seats were going to be decided in the final days of the campaign was really at.
Let's move on to another polling disaster, because they seem to be coming in batches. It may be disasters a bit harsh, but in Greece, obviously there's been the referendum that's just gone. The opinion polls seem to show a race that was neck and neck, and then a result that was anything but. I mean, you know, what are your thoughts on that? It feels like these sorts of referendums that are quite quick and haphazard.
Oh, it's a complete
quite
nightmare.
Difficult to poll.
Oh, there but for the grace of God go I. I mean, it's an absolute recipe for polling disaster from the start of it.
Why did you say that?
Well, you've got... So, You've got a question that even on the ballot paper, I would argue quite a lot of people voting in that referendum didn't understand. So phrasing that, and hugely long, I don't know if you heard some of those radio reports, but you know, the question took about 5 minutes to read because, you know, it just said no and then yes had like more or less the entire text of the sort of the you know, the deal that had been given them by the IMF or whoever it was. So difficult question to interpret. No time whatsoever to think, you know, to be able to do things. So you're, you know, relatively limited in your method, in some of your methodologies that you might want to go for in terms of that. You know, very few reference points, continually changing political makeup of the electorate in Greece. You know, Syriza going from, I get the figures wrong, but, you know, from single digits to, you know, having a majority, you know, a plurality of the votes and the majority of the seats, you know. All of these things in constant shift, so very few reference points to get your sample against, and also hugely complicated things. I believe in Greece that, you know, people vote in their the place where they were born or where they were registered as an adult or whatever, which means that lots of people living in Athens are actually registered to vote on islands, so they have to go home to vote, which always causes immense amounts of chaos in terms of, you know, your sampling frame and so on. So, like, on every possible level, an absolutely toxic thing to have to try and to call. So I'm sort of fairly sympathetic to the pollsters in this case. But again, it kind of goes back to the thing of, like, well, if it's that difficult and it's that inaccurate, then what value did it have? I mean, the fact is, I think the final poll, which came out possibly or may have gone into field before even the, you know, on the Thursday, so, you know, 3 days into the campaign, if you like, but 3 days before the actual vote, I think came out with, you know, no having a 1% lead or something like that. And obviously it turned out to be a lot more different than that. But, you know, constantly changing thing. I think lots of people not necessarily made up their minds. Lots of people not understanding the question. And also external forces continually changing things. You know, there was, I think, an IMF report on the Thursday, maybe, that probably shifted, in a sense, what the question was. But people went into the voting booth not knowing whether voting no meant that they were going to be leaving the EU. That was what, you know, the Commission was claiming, certainly at the beginning of the week. So, you know, really horrible thing to poll.
Suzanne, do you have any thoughts on the Greek polling?
Yeah, I feel sorry for Greek pollsters. but yeah, I mean, even if it's imperfect information, that's still information. And yes, polls can be sometimes misleading. I think it's about also learning how to understand what a poll means and how uncertain they can be. And so even though it's imperfect information, that's still good to have, I think.
I suppose this raises a question for our own EU referendum, we could argue that it is a different thing to what's happened in Greece. I mean, Suzanne, I'll go to you. Referendum polling is quite different, isn't it, to polling for an election, isn't it? So, I mean, do you see that the British EU referendum being quite a difficult one to call right?
Well, I mean, after May, I wouldn't be caught on tape saying that, yes, it's going to be really easy to predict any election. Yeah, I think it's going to be a difficult one, first of all, because we don't have any reference. So it's quite hard to calibrate your sample to be sure you have the right number of Eurosceptics and non-Eurosceptics. And then I seem to understand that Eurosceptics can be harder to reach populations. So all that work that the British Polling Council...
Maybe because they're older and certain demographic groups?
They're older, they're less engaged politically sometimes. They're people we're not used to sort of necessarily focusing on. So we have some Labour Eurosceptics, Conservative Eurosceptics, and we have to make sure that in each sample we have the right number of Labour and Labour Eurosceptics. So that's going to be quite a challenge. Yeah, I think so. Mm.
And Rob, I suspect that the question wording is going to be quite interesting, isn't it, in terms of the EU referendum? I'm very intrigued by the use of the word remain in the European Union that's in there. It seems to me that that's, I don't know whether it's going to shift any results, but it's going to certainly frame the debate a bit, isn't it?
Yeah, I think the key thing is, and this is what wasn't necessarily, is so two things. One is what the question means and then what the implications are for those different things. I think nobody could argue that in Scotland it wasn't clear what side yes was and what side no was in terms of what the implications were. I mean, you could argue about whether the implications of a yes vote in terms of currency and the Queen or whatever else it was that was sort of debated as sort of unknowns would be borne out. But I think most people would have a fairly strong understanding of what the most important and, you know, elements of the question are. I'm not convinced it makes a huge amount of difference. There's some evidence, I think, that the status quo it's unclear whether there's a status quo bias or a no bias, if you see what I mean. So at the moment, the remain in and therefore yes being the status quo, that could be important. But
we've had no to AV, we've had no to Scotland's independence.
Yeah, so no has been the status quo in those cases.
No in Greece, different situation. Yeah.
And similarly in Canada with independence and Quebec, it was no was the you know, remaining a union. So there is some evidence, I believe, that you know that no tends to win, but it's not clear whether it's no or the status quo.
Well, it feels like we're focusing on polling that's quite difficult today. So why not move on to another one? The Labour leadership race is obviously going on and will be until September. I think ballots go out in August, I think, if I might be right. Suzanne, I mean, this feels like there's quite an absence of polling about the Labour leadership so far. I think there was an ORB poll recently that asked which of the candidates were most likely to make Labour win again, which didn't feel particularly useful, not least because there didn't seem to be a don't know option in there. But I mean, what are the difficulties when it comes to sort of polling a leadership contest like the Labour leadership as opposed to, you know, an election?
Well, the main issue is that we don't know who's going to vote and we don't know anything about that electorate. We don't know who they are, what their demographics are. So it's really, really hard to poll. So at this stage, right, polling is a very useful indication of where the public opinion lies. I don't think we should take the numbers as an actual prediction of who's going to win the leadership contest. I think there are some interesting things that one can do about that, so knowing about how much people know about candidates and how they position them, but it's in no way a prediction of who's going to win. Mm. It's just pointers at this stage.
Mm. And not least, Rob, I suppose, because actually the Labour leadership is a lot to do with second preferences and things like this, and none of that's been taken into account yet. I mean, presumably you share Suzanne's view that, you know, given the polling difficulties that the industry's been having, sticking your neck out on the Labour leadership probably isn't the best next step, is it?
Yeah. I think I would take a huge pinch of salt. I think Suzanne's exactly right. The sort of the polls, whether national polls or ones of Labour members that look at the familiarity with the candidates, I think that's reasonably interesting, though probably not that surprising in terms of who can pick out. I think there's some polling about who can pick out, you know, who Andy Burnham is in a lineup and so on, which
I think has the greatest levels of awareness, I think.
And it's still pretty low, right? I mean, it's sort of a constant reminder of how, you know, a few people, even in focus groups, you have people like, I remember the last election, who like genuinely would not have been able to pick out Ed Miliband and Cameron in a lineup. And I think this is sort of a huge assumption of engagement that people have, particularly whether in our industry or the media or wherever else, in terms of like the low levels of pickup. You know, plenty of people were picking out Ed Miliband as Andy Burnham in those kind of things. You know, Ipsos Mori always have, I think, as one of their questions. There's, I forget the name, but they always have one guy who's a completely made up name. And that person always gets, you know, 6% in their polls for who's going to be the next Labour leader. It's like, you know, Dave Smith or whatever. Mm. So I think a huge pinch of salt. The Labour electorate, I can't remember the exact numbers, but what we're talking, 100, 150,000 people or something. That's a pretty small number of people to even, you know, try to go and find, and worse, to try and get robustly and representative. I think probably YouGov, with their big panel and their knowledge of their party members, is probably the only one that I would even begin to think about being a valid kind of reflection of where the race is at. I think the national polling, especially if it doesn't allow for the fact that the people might not know the candidates, anything there is just going to be about familiarity. Rather, you know, if you say who is most likely to, you know, lead Labour out of the wilderness, and people, but the people will pick the one that they've heard of rather than say, you know, rather than someone that they haven't heard of. So Burnham, I think, who came out on top in terms of familiarity, does particularly well there. So yeah, I think hugely difficult. I think one interesting piece of analysis, which is about the last leadership election, which was the correlation between, I believe, how CLP members voted and their MP, who, if they had the ability to cast a preference. So I think that therefore the nominations is sort of, I don't want to say that the MPs like tell their constituents how to vote, but I think some of them probably do and do speak positively of the ones that they are, you know, comradely with, to sort of put it like that. So I think that's quite interesting in terms of, you know, who's doing well in terms of nominations and whether people think that will be an important decisive factor. But yeah, we saw in 2010 with Ed Miliband's victory that, you know, the second preferences make second or even fourth preferences make an enormous amount of difference if it's going to be a tight contest. I believe some have said that it's possible that Jeremy Corbyn will, you know, come top on first preferences, which I find quite surprising. But, you know, if that's true, then that will just make absolutely explicit. And, you know, presumably the other candidates' preferences will coalesce behind them.
But I suppose even with the CLP nominations, and I confess I don't have data on this specific point I'm about to make, but presumably there are large bodies of Labour Party members that don't go to these CLP meetings. So yep. you've got a difference between those sort of activists, if you like, that are actually going to nominate somebody at a meeting, and these people that aren't, that are sitting at home. And then when you factor into that, the fact that there's likely, I suspect, in this race in particular, a large body of don't know, then it feels like it's very, very early. It's a bit early to call the race. I suspect there's a lot of venting going on in the Labour Party at the moment in terms of, you know, the shock of the result and people being very upset about it. But actually, as you approach August and September, I don't know, maybe people will sort of start thinking more, dare I say, seriously about who the next leader is going to be. I don't know.
Well, I think it's fair to say that the Corbyn campaign is very, very energised and has lots of people doing stuff. And because it makes the race more interesting, is getting a lot of media time. I don't think I would want to characterise that as unserious. I think it's deeply serious. I think the people that support him are, you know, really believe that. I think the other three candidates have found it quite difficult to differentiate themselves between each other because of him entering the race. And you've seen today with, in some ways, it might be helpful. So Andy Burnham previously was being sort of characterised as the left candidate with the support of Len McCluskey. That we've seen today that Unite have come out and supported, or yesterday that Unite have come out and supported Corbyn. So there's a sense in which perhaps Burnham is losing some of the baggage that he might have collected as being the quote unquote most left candidate in the race. That could, you know, be actually quite helpful to him if he were to win. That he wasn't the choice of Unite in terms of, you know, Ed Miliband had quite a lot of baggage associated with that, and so that might not be the case this time. My sense is that, you know, Corbyn will do better than people thought at the beginning, but that, you know, the other three candidates' preferences will likely, you know, dominate.
We've obviously been speaking a lot about France today, what with the polling regulations that Suzanne was mentioning earlier. I mean, I'm quite interested in what happens in France with their sort of presidential primaries, because I know that Labour, Rob, are obviously having this kind of supporters thing where you pay £3 and there are all these Tories for Corbyn that allegedly are paying £3 to sort of nominate him. I mean, Suzanne, what happens...
Happily take their money, thanks.
I mean, Suzanne, what happens in France? What's the experience there? And what's going to happen for the presidential election next time?
Well, for the presidential elections next time, so the Conservative Party, Les Républicains, has just accepted the idea that there will be an open primary. The question is how open and how many people are actually going to take part. So I think all the problems we have sort of trying to get good polling on Labour leadership is going to be just the same in France with the right wing. But there was a very successful experience in the Socialist Party before François Hollande's election, where they had completely open primaries that actually brought 1 million people to vote. And it was just a case.
1 million? Wow.
Yeah, I think over 1 million. But the one big difference was that it was much closer to the election. So you were choosing the candidate and it was much closer to the election. So that made a massive difference. And I think that explains why so many people voted.
And it's a presidential system, so you're voting for the person who is going to be president of France, which is slightly different to leader of the parliamentary Labour Party.
For 5 years. And
for 5 years.
May or may not be, yeah. It feels very, very different. So presumably, again, we've got, you know, trying to poll around that, much as, you know, it's going to be virtually impossible.
Well, it depends. For the Socialist Party in 2012, that wasn't too bad, actually. It wasn't completely accurate within 1 point. But it was actually...
gave a fairly good clue that Hollande was going to...
Yeah, it was expected that Hollande was going to win. But for the Conservative Party, last time in 2012, they had a very complicated election that caused everyone to call each other cheats and big drama. But all the polls got it completely wrong because the base was much smaller and a lot less people voted. So I think it's really a case about how many people vote and how much you know about who's going to go and vote, yeah.
That was Polling Matters in association with politicalbetting.com. Thanks very much once again to my guests Rob Vance and Suzanne Manassian. Lots of interesting points to consider there for the polling industry as we move forward. I suspect until the BPC inquiry is completed that there any Westminster voting intention polls that are conducted may very well be taken with a heavy pinch of salt, insofar as any are actually conducted. We've seen some so far, but I suspect we'll see more gradually around the conference season. In terms of the Labour leadership contest, I don't think we're going to see too much in the way of who's going to win, but we might see a fair bit in terms of who the best candidate is and their characteristics and how electable they are and so on. And then I guess next year what we're going to see is more around the sort of Scottish parliamentary elections and the EU referendum as that campaign sort of gradually takes shape. But certainly lots to consider for the polling industry when we consider that I don't think it's in its interest to get two elections in a row wrong. So very, very high stakes for the polling industry if it's going to remain relevant in the future. But that said, of course, the media's need for data remains, and I think that after the BPC inquiry we're still going to see a sort of appetite for that, provided that sort of satisfactory answers are given in terms of what went wrong in 2015 in the general election. But of course the only way we're ever going to know that things are fixed is if the result of the 2020 general election or whatever that election is adequately called by the pollsters. But certainly lots to think about, and we'll be keeping an eye on that and continuing to keep you informed. The music you're about to hear is Pollinate by Kirk Pearson, licensed under Creative Commons. And stay tuned for more episodes of Polling Matters in the coming week.